Good afternoon, everybody. So welcome to Tangled Routes to Japanese American Redress. We're in room Willow A on the second floor, just for those that are still searching for another session, but this is for Tangled Routes to Japanese American Redress. My name is Ania Yoshizumi, and I'll be your host. And I just wanted to do a couple of housekeeping things before we start off. So, of course, there will be no taping, video or audio. The panels are being professionally audio recorded, and streaming audio files will be available on the jan.org website following the conference. Of course, restrooms are right around the corner. Take a right outside and also straight down the hall there. But other than that, I will go ahead and introduce our moderator. His name is Bob Shimabukuro.
Well, good afternoon. I think we'll just get right into it because we're all in a strict time limit here. I want to introduce the panel. Arlene Oki is a longtime board member and past president of the Seattle area chapter of JACL, and she is currently vice president for civil rights. She also has served as secretary of Pacific Northwest District Council of JACL, as well as the Program for Action Committee. She began her career in government as a special assistant to Seattle Mayor Charles Royer and later as a human services planner in the Seattle Human Services Department.
Oh, no, I'm looking at a picture of Mayor Royer and those who worked on redress. It's really a long time ago. It's wonderful. You'll see it on the screen, too, or perhaps you saw it already. I was very passionate about the issue of redress, but I have to admit I was on the margins of the movement. Having three young children and deep concerns about the quality of the schools they were attending took up most of my time and energy. What I will share with you today are a few personal recollections of the community's tangled route to redress. Or actually, it was rather a rocky road to redress. My early involvement began in the mid-1970s when I was asked to join the Seattle chapter, JACL, and to become its secretary. It was a period when hot debates whirled around the issue of redress. Some members felt an apology was all that was necessary, or that nothing should be done to draw attention to the camp experience. Others believed that the only way to make a lasting impact on such unconstitutional acts by the U.S. government was to seek monetary redress along with an apology. You can just imagine how difficult it was to take minutes when the meetings were filled with yelling interspersed with quiet, eloquent comments from individuals like Dr. Min Masuda. I finally had to tape all the conversations to keep my notes as accurate as possible. From that point on, I realized that it would be a major task to forge consensus on the matter of redress. In addition to the verbal assaults and debates, there was a tremendous amount of undercutting and backstabbing going on. Cultural factors messed up our relentless effort to achieve redress. Historically, our community does not want to draw attention to themselves, partly due to the incarceration experience and partly due to a culture where modesty, respect for authority, and moderation are valued to an almost extreme level. We found that many in the community who were not active JACL members did not want to bring attention to our plight. There were many disappointments and failures to achieve consensus on what form redress would take in those early days. National JACL leaders and local activists were often at odds over strategies. Clearly, something needed to happen to bring the community together to draw attention to the campaign for redress. It all started to change when Frank Chen arrived on the scene in 1978. He came here to write an article about redress for a local newspaper, But in the process of developing the story, he had an idea, a brilliant idea, to organize a major media event. With the assistance of Frank Abe and Kathy Wong, also from the Bay Area, and members of the Seattle JSCL, a Day of Remembrance rally was held at the Puyallup Fairgrounds, where Seattle area Japanese Americans were sent to be assigned to the camps. Frank Abe will talk about the tremendous impact of that rally when it is his turn to speak. Though the Day of Remembrance was held on November 25, 1978, it continues to be observed in many cities across the country on February 19th, the day when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 to forcibly remove almost 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry from their homes. The dynamic trio from San Francisco really challenged Seattle JSCLers to make the campaign for redress more visible and to make us take some stronger steps, risk-taking steps, to make it happen. At the time, there were moments when I thought, oh, my gosh, another Saul Alinsky group we have to deal with. After working on his campaign, I had the privilege of working for Seattle Mayor Charles Royer, who supported the community's efforts to achieve redress. With his support, I worked with local constituents who were advocating for that cause. We were approached by Frank Chien, Frank Abe, and Kathy Wong to have the mayor sign on to sign an open letter to U.S. Senator S.I. Hayakawa, rebutting his negative comments on redress, which were published in mainstream newspapers. The letter, which included the names of other big city mayors and thousands of Japanese Americans across the country, appeared in the Washington Post. Does political activism matter? Okay, I'm a political junkie. The whole realm of political intrigue, issues, and personalities is of constant interest to me. I became a precinct committee person in the Democratic Party and worked on local, state, and national campaigns. During the time when many in our community were advocating for redress, there were just a few Japanese Americans who were active in partisan politics. A few of us worked to include language supporting monetary redress in the Democratic Party's national platform for the presidential and congressional elections of 1980 and 1984. Sadly, not many politicians ever take the time to read this document. But for party leaders, it did draw attention to the concerns of a segment of the population which had not previously been heard. I vividly recall the statement of a delegate to the State Democratic Convention, an elderly man from the San Juan Islands, who used the J word during his comments on the floor debate about redress. I recall the actions of one JSL board member who was also a precinct committee person in the Democratic Party. As a longtime supporter, he convinced U.S. Senator Henry Jackson to oppose any form of reparations. Henry Jackson had the reputation of being very loyal to his early supporters, and he really did follow this JSCLer's advice. Senator Jackson's seatmate, Senator Warren Magnuson, was somewhat supportive, but he lost his seat to former Governor Dan Evans, a moderate Republican who immediately signed on as co-sponsor of the Senate's redress bill. It was really great to see Japanese Americans who were up to then apolitical suddenly become knowledgeable about key legislative leaders and strategies to influence their decisions. The transformation happened all over the country as redress advocates started visiting legislators and their policy staff, wrote letters, raised money, and made numerous phone calls to get the community involved. In Seattle, an Asian American committee worked to elect Mike Lowry to represent the 7th Congressional District. Several members of the committee briefed him and urged him to work for redress once he was elected. After the election, we asked him to hire someone from our community who was familiar with the plan to seek monetary redress. Though a friend of mine with great credentials wanted to work for the newly elected congressman, I urged him to hire Ruth Ann Carosi instead because I knew she was knowledgeable about the issue. Congressman Lowry, who is now today our hero, introduced the first redress bill, and others followed with minor modifications. There are sometimes difficult decisions to make in politics. Thankfully, the other Asian American woman continues to be my best friend. The power of the press. The media has the power to inform, but also to influence key decisions made by our policymakers. It is really unfortunate that the print media is no longer the primary source of information for the public today. And with so much media consolidation, it appears very likely that the news we received in the future will be filtered and controlled by powerful corporate elites. As a delegate from Washington State to the 1976 Democratic Convention, I had the opportunity to talk with a political reporter from the Seattle Times about our World War II experience and the campaign for redress. Though it was only a line or two, I was happy to see the issue in one of his daily convention reports in the Times. The mid-70s was also a time when school activists were working to desegregate Seattle public schools through a mandatory busing plan. Fred Barbash, a journalist from the Washington Post, arrived in Seattle to gather information about the Seattle plan before oral arguments were to be presented in the U.S. Supreme Court. Because I was vice chair of the district-wide advisory committee for desegregation, he requested an interview with me. During one of our long conversations, mostly about Brown versus Board of Education, the issue of redress to address the unconstitutional incarceration of Americans of Japanese ancestry came up. As someone who grew up in the Midwest, he admitted to knowing hardly anything about this gross violation of constitutional protections and wanted to know more. He was surprised to discover only a short paragraph about the forcible removal of Japanese Americans from their homes into concentration camps in the archives of the Washington Post. As a reporter assigned to the Supreme Court and understanding that legal challenges would almost certainly be presented, he became very interested in the issue. I compiled a bibliography about the Japanese-American experience during World War II and redress for him, and I think he read every one of the books. In no time, he received approval from the Post to take a sabbatical to visit what was left of the camps and conduct research on Executive Order 9066, our community, and possible legal challenges. He subsequently wrote a very long five-piece series, which appeared on the front pages of the Washington Post. The articles with photos appeared in the Post just a week or two before Congress would vote on the redress bill. It was an excellent series of reports, which in my mind should have won him a Pulitzer Prize. As you know, instead of redress, Congress established the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. The findings of the commission led to a bill to finally grant reparations to members of our community who were incarcerated in World War II camps. Fred Barbash's contribution to our cause was enormous, not only educating the public about the gross violation of civil rights experienced by Americans of Japanese ancestry and the campaign for redress, but educating the president and members of Congress who would eventually vote on H.R. 442, the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. Many wanted to leave this sorry legacy of U.S. history buried forever. Achieving redress was indeed a daunting task, but with a deep sensitivity to the community's concerns, smart strategic planning, total dedication, and a passion for doing what was right, it was finally achieved. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Frank Abe, who is the producer and director of the award-winning PBS documentary Conscious and the Constitution, and of the new two-disc collector's edition DVD of the film. He helped produce the first two Days of Remembrance media events in Seattle and Portland that publicly dramatized the campaign for redress, and that's where I met both Frank Abe and Frank Chin, the two Franks they used to call them. But he's going to talk about Days of Remembrance.
Thank you, Bob. Okay, so thank you. I want to welcome you all to Seattle. I like to think of Seattle as the home of Japanese-American redress campaign, home of the first Day of Remembrance and the first redress bill. My story today is, in my humble opinion, how Seattle saved redress. We didn't win it here 25 years ago, but I will argue that we rescued it 35 years ago. And I'll argue that we rescued it 35 years ago from being killed in the press before it even got off the ground. We did it by changing the story and reframing the debate. Arlene told you a little bit about the backstabbing and inner disagreement inside JACL and the community in the late 70s. Here are some of the people Arlene mentioned, not backstabbers, but that's Mayor Royer, Min Masuda, from the right, Min Masuda, Cherry Kinoshita, Floyd Schmo, Ron Mamiya, Arlene, Shosuke Sasaki, and Henry Miyatake. So if we were doing this campaign today, we would just create a Facebook community page, a Twitter account, and a change.org online petition, which we did do for Stop the Fence at Tule Lake. But this was before the internet. Seattle had to rely on personal contact, direct mail, and the news media. So this is how grassroots the campaign was. The Seattle Evacuation Redress Committee was four Boeing engineers and a retired securities analyst, Shosuke. On the table are the flip charts that Henry wrote by hand and lugged with him to talk to congressmen, community groups, anyone who would listen to his story, his logical argument on flip charts. He's an engineer. Why the camps were wrong, why reparation was justified, and how Japanese Americans could, in fact, fund it themselves with an income tax checkoff plan. So these were smart guys. And I want you to hear the voice of Shosuke Sasaki, our Issei intellectual.
We'd like to have that 3 or 3.5 years back, but you can't. And if you people can think of any other way that redress can be provided, I'd like to hear it. Just ask yourself, would you be willing to submit to exile and imprisonment for 3 or 3.5 years for an average of $15,000 plus $15 a day.
So Shosuke wrote and spoke with authority, a big voice like Jimmy Stewart coming out of a man once described as Tweety Bird. The Seattle group recorded Shosuke reading his manifesto, An Appeal for Action, and sent the cassette tape and flip charts to every JACL chapter across the country, 98 of them. In part, it read, "Wartime propaganda brainwashed most white Americans into feeling that the Japanese were subhuman creatures deserving of no rights whatsoever. It brainwashed Japanese Americans into thinking that they had been born of an unworthy race and that they had to submit meekly to government trampling of their human rights in order to prove to others that the Nisei were loyal Americans. If Japanese Americans are as American as some Nisei writers often claim," and here he could only have meant Bill Hosokawa, "then they should act like Americans and make every effort to seek redress through legislation and the courts." So that's not the overheated rhetoric of a sansei agitator. That's the writing of a very articulate Issei intellectual. At the 1978 JACL National Convention, the delegates passed a historic resolution calling for individual redress of $25,000. The speaker at the closing banquet was Republican California Senator S.I. Hayakawa. A reporter from the Salt Lake City Tribune asked him afterward what he thought of redress. Well, Hayakawa called the JACL resolution absurd and ridiculous. He said people like Shosuke were projecting their feelings back 37 years, The relocation was perfectly understandable, he said. Even JACL supported it at the time. And for JACL to ask for restitution, he said, was the rekindling of resentment and racism that no longer exists. So this is a guy who would fit right in with Fox News Channel if he were still with us today, right? The story went national via the wire services. Wall Street Journal backed him up. Editorial called guilt-mongering. Racial prejudice against Japanese Americans is almost dead, it wrote. Half the third-generation Japanese Americans are intermarrying. Japanese are being absorbed, and JACL is an organization without a future. And it snarled, why is this coming up now? Obviously, JACL has been inspired by the example of other self-appointed ethnic spokesmen snapping at compensation for ancient wrongs under the guise of human rights. And the paper bemoaned a society in which collective guilt for past sins has become a commodity to be traded, mongered, and exploited. So, yes, you could feel the air leaking out of the redress balloon. Redress was not getting good press. Nisei felt betrayed and angry, but helpless in the face of powerful politicians and newspapers, not unlike how you all felt in World War II. The fact is that National JACL, having publicly raised the issue, didn't know how to answer these critics or to mount an effective media campaign. I later learned their media plan was one about communicating with chapters and having discussions, and one that did not engage the news media. So this was a pivotal moment in our history. And in this moment, the writer Frank Chin, and I know some people hate him, but Frank came to my door in South Seattle. We'd done some theater together, hadn't seen him in a few years. First thing he says, he commands, Abe, if Japanese Americans lose redress, you can kiss Japanese American art goodbye. That is to say, without public consensus about that the camps were wrong, our history was no more than opinion and hearsay on talk radio, not unlike Fox News Channel today. But our history was subject to those who could yell the loudest. So to Henry and Shosuke's credit, they recognized that Frank and I and others could help. Redress needed to earn positive media coverage. So Frank's strategy was to stage a public event. His first idea was that on Thanksgiving Day, 1978, all the Japanese Americans in Seattle would assemble in Pioneer Square with our bags packed and recreate the eviction from Seattle, with army trucks leading the way back to the Puyallup Fairgrounds where we'd get inside and then refuse to leave. And if they try to kick us out of the fairgrounds, we'd chain ourselves to the fences and get arrested. Henry and Shosuke screamed that Frank was nuts. And no one's going to go out on Thanksgiving. People will be with their families. Okay, so we adjusted the plan. It would happen the Saturday of Thanksgiving weekend, and it'd be a family event with a potluck luncheon and a talent show. Okay? And so you see the poster here, actually, of a sample here signed by all the participants. But it's the poster, the language is framed as a dinner or invitation or a wedding invitation to all persons of Japanese ancestry and friends. The memory of 120,313 Issei, Nisei, Sansei, and others of Japanese ancestry request the pleasure of your company for a day of remembrance. Now, the next two lines at the top here are key, crafted to send three messages. Remember the concentration camps. Stand for redress with your families. First, it signals this is a family event. Second, as Mako Nakagawa would now say, we use the power of words, concentration camps, which evidently is still a controversial term today. But nevertheless, it's out there. And third, the word redress is slipped in the middle. We needed to signal this was a political action, but framed as a non-threatening, commemorative family event. So, as Arlene mentioned, you know, just using the word redress at the time was touchy with a lot of older Nisei. We took this poster to the local bowling alley, Imperial Lanes, and the manager refused to let us put it up. You know, I don't want that redress thing in my bowling alley. I have a lot of white customers, don't want a rocket vote. Okay, so for weeks leading up to the event, we got advanced stories in the local press. All the local papers featured local Nisei and their personal stories of camp. We edited Shosuke's appeal for action as an op-ed for the Seattle Times, and the logo, Ichinisan logo, designed by Frank Fuji of Mercer Island. Yasuko will talk more about that later, but that gave us a brand an identity. And the media, all the media stories had the same Ichi Nisan logo, which really drove home the point and unified our message. We got reams of free media in advance, but we didn't know if anyone would show up. The first hint was a few days before Thanksgiving. The contact number we gave, which was David Ishii's bookstore number, began to ring with questions from people asking, what shall I bring? What shall I wear? And on the morning of November 25th, we were stunned when we arrived at Sixth Stadium on Rainier Avenue and found people waiting in line with cars, ready to form a caravan to recreate a mass eviction from Seattle. People were ready for this to happen. We provided the spark, but the energy was right there. Congressman Mike Lowry, I know you were there. Thank you for being there. I know that I heard a story that Frank saw you there and recognized the opportunity to ask you to jump on the back of a pickup truck and yell at the crowd for that you were, and you, on your own, I'm told, voluntarily said, I will submit a redress bill in Congress. Yeah, too much wild applause. Is that true? It's not true. Oh, okay. Okay. Good. Okay. Well, that's a good story anyway. Well,
but it was when a delegation came and asked it.
Oh.
And actually, I well remember the meeting you're talking about, which was a great gathering.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Now, as to what I said when I got up on the back of that truck, I have no idea.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
I believe you.
Okay. Okay. Well, one of our group arranged through the governor's office for the loan of some National Guard trucks and buses. Someone put a poster on the side. And these led the car caravan down I-5 to Puyallup, just like in 1942. The line of cars stretched for miles down the highway. And inside the cars, something remarkable happened. Parents opened up to their kids for the first time in the privacy of their cars, going to Puyallup, right? And all the memories start coming back. And they finally start telling their stories about what happened to them in the war. So the ice was broken. So I'm going to play for you one TV story that was shot the day before the event. Ignore the reporter's voiceover, but I want you to see the footage, the pictures of what the Puyallup Fairgrounds looked like when it was a camp and the preparations for the program inside.
For Tom Takamura, a walk through the Western Washington Fairgrounds brings back the memories of the day he says will live forever in infamy. Not the bombing of Pearl Harbor, but an April day several months later, when he and 7,000 other Japanese Americans were rounded.
There's the fairgrounds.
This makeshift internment camp, built in the shadows of a roller coaster, which still stands today.
Well, there was a time when a little child went to retrieve a ball, and he was fired upon.
This weekend, Tom Takamura and more than 1,000 of those interned here will return to what was once known as Camp Harmony.
Camp Art exhibit.
For most, it will be their first trip back since the end of World War II.
BPO Holiday Little Talent Show.
These third-generation Japanese Americans are going through their final rehearsal. They're going to recreate an old camp variety show. Some of the works of art put together during the long days of World War II will be on display this weekend. Next year, the Japanese American Association will introduce legislation in Congress to seek more than $3 billion in war reparations. $25,000 for every Japanese American imprisoned during a forgotten period of American history. There'll be a potluck in Camp Harmony and an award ceremony, honoring the people who've done well after leaving behind a traumatic but often overlooked chapter in American history.
In the poster. So every newspaper and TV station was there to see the largest gathering of Japanese Americans in Seattle since World War II. We showed we could get the media on our side. The Seattle Times front page story got carried nationwide by the Associated Press, and what people had feared most never happened, and that was there was no white backlash, no angry mob, no rekindling of old resentments and racism. Yasuko will have more to say about how this first day of remembrance was an emotional breakthrough for our community. What I'll say is it sent a shockwave at the time and kickstarted the popular campaign for redress in the news media and inside our own community. So in the space of 3 months, from August to November, we went from this to this. $3 billion is a small price to pay. This is from a young David Horsey, now a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist at the LA Times. Right? He puts a human face on redress with the Issei grandfather here on the side. Ron Mamiya knew David, and that's how he got this thing into his head. Portland. Jim Sugimura and Bones Onishi from the JUCL in Portland said, hey, we want one of our own. So we went down to Portland for 6 weeks. This is the first day of remembrance to be hooked to the anniversary of EO 966, February 19th. 1,200 came out. This time the pitch was a pilgrimage from downtown Portland to dedicate a plaque at the Expo Center, site of the Portland Assembly Center. So what's important to remember here, I'm going to wrap up here in a second, is that while Sansei, like myself, were helping organize these events, we were organizing to serve the needs and the desires of the Nisei in Seattle and Portland at their request. Okay, I say this because Senator Hayakawa was back. He publicly accused the Days of Remembrance of being a JACL front. He said that they were led by Sansei radicals who never spent a day in camp. So Frank came up with a new strategy. We would write and publish an open letter to Senator Hayakawa and publish it as a paid ad in all the major metropolitan dailies. Karen Saraguchi found out how much that would cost and convinced Frank to narrow it just to the Washington Post, where it would be seen by members of Congress. Okay? So a Portland event, we launched the fundraising campaign, took out ads in the PC, Pacific Citizen, asked for a minimum $5 donation to add your name to the letter, no charge for the essay. In less than 3 months, we raised $10,000 to take out a three-quarter page ad in the Washington Post. It's published on May 9th. This was, of course, this was a very concise argument for Japanese American redress, couched in the form of an open letter to a national reactionary political leader. You, Senator Hayakawa, were not there with us on the West Coast. You were not with us in the camps. We regret that you choose now to make your reputation by characterizing yourself as our public enemy number one. You call yourself that as if the title brings you glory. In our eyes, it does not. And on the concentration camps and our concern for redress, you do not speak for Japanese America. The whites of today are different people. Today, the mayors of the cities that once called for our elimination are welcoming us home. In Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco, the white establishment, far from reviving their race hatred, are joining with us to remember, to heal, and to encourage the triumph of law. We firmly believe American law can heal itself. We look to you as one of the physicians, and we are saddened by your mouthing of the cliches of an ancient mob. To leverage our investment in the ad, we held simultaneous press conferences in San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, and Chicago. George Takei helped us out in Los Angeles. And again, we got local headlines as well as national media coverage. In response, Senator Hayakawa's press secretary would only say the senator is very sensitive about it and he wants to think about it. So, yeah. So, great. I mean, that's the story of how in 3 months we changed the story, turned around public opinion, reframed the story of reparations from a focus on the money to a focus on the people and the injustice. It was a blitzkrieg action that turned crisis into opportunity to leverage the power of the media and leverage the power of our own voices, or the Nisei, to tell our collective story together for the first time since resettlement. This was the spark that, again, kick-started the popular campaign. And this is why I think I have some justification for saying that Seattle is the spiritual home for Japanese American redress. So thank you all for coming to Seattle. And next we hear from Yasuko.
As Frank said, the next speaker is Yasuko Takezawa, who is a professor of cultural anthropology at the Institute for Research in Humanities, Kyoto University, and affiliate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Washington. She lived in Seattle in the 1980s while attending University of Washington as a graduate student and is the author of Breaking the Silence, Redress, and the Japanese American Ethnicity, published by Cornell University. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. It is a great honor to be part of this panel. As he said, I was here in the 80s, and I'm the only one who left Seattle, but this is my hometown in the States. I'm going to talk from a cultural anthropologist's viewpoint what Seattle Japanese American community contributed to redress. And I think there are, largely speaking, five factors that did for redress. One, an individual payment plan, and two, an American promise, three, first day of remembrance, as Frank talked about it. And fourth, organize campaigns, diverse groups. And five, local artists. Now I will start with individual payment plan. Since Frank Abe already discussed to some extent, so I will just touch the essence. I think there was a really deep and intense division between national JSCL and the Seattle chapter JSCL here. And national JSCL, they pushed for trust fund. They thought, actually, Mike Masaoka, he recollects in his co-authored book with Bill Hosokawa in Nisei, he said, I thought it is a collective crime. Well, I believe the evacuation was a collective crime against a group, and that compensation should primarily benefit the group through community projects, homes for the elderly, and the like. But Seattle chapter, they insisted it should be individual payment. It was, they thought it was a violation of human rights. It was really violate the individual rights. And if we take the national JSCL's plan of trust fund, then people who live in remote areas, you know, people there where there are no Japanese American communities, are very, very tiny communities, they would benefit nothing from the elderly home or community projects. But I'd like to just a little bit discuss where this where the idea of individual payment came from. Henry Miyatake, who is still alive in where is he? But at South Seattle. But he started all by himself. He started research by going to libraries and digging books. And in 1972, he found there are previous cases. And he used this book, How to Find the Law. And he found several cases. And one was like there were German trading companies whose property was confiscated by U.S. government, and they made lawsuits in U.S. courts, and they got their property, if not all, they got some of their property back or compensation back. And then there was also a case, Native American, Native Indian involved, Lambding Milligan. He was an Indian who was arrested in 1864 and imprisoned because he refused to join the Union Army during the Civil War. So he sued the U.S. government and for loss of his civil liberty and a misappropriation of property. So because finding these cases, Henry Miyatake thought, well, it can be possible. It may be possible that this individual payment for reparation was possible. Second, an American promise. In late 1975, when there was nothing, you know, this intense conflict between National GS and Seattle chapter, Seattle Evacuation Redress Committee found out that Executive Order 9066 remained active. It was still active. So on February 19th, 1976, the meaningful day, President Gerald Ford signed Proclamation 2714, titled An American Promise. How they did it? They contacted Governor Daniel Evans' office and through that office to White House. So they got attention of the White House. So An American Promise, I don't read everything here, but it is saying recognition of our national mistakes. And not only was that evacuation wrong, so now this is the first federal acknowledgement that evacuation and incarceration was wrong. But how many of you in this room knew about this? Could you raise your hand? Just one or two, three? See why, you know, why people don't know, even those who are here in this room, because no monetary reparation, no monetary issue was involved. So I think this case proved, you know, no matter how important this was, it improved how monetary compensation, this idea was really important to get public attention and also to educate the general public. Number three is Day of Remembrance. Since he, Frank Abbott, did a marvelous presentation with great images. But I'd like to point out the role of the first Day of Remembrance, because as I said, you know, there was a long stagnation. Nothing was happening because, you know, there was this very, very intense dispute. But 1973 was a break. It really served as a breakthrough. And historian Eric Hobsbawm, he coined the term invented tradition. And I think this was really invented tradition in Japanese-American community. They use the symbols, meaningful symbols, important symbols, such as barbed wire, guard tower, peel up, and bassin, and so forth, to evoke memories. So the invented means it symbols, they use the symbols from the past, but it cannot be identical. It has to be different. There should be similar but different. So there were new things, new meanings added. Like there were lots of white friends. There were sansei, young people. Media was there. Lots of media was there. And it was communal, you know, community, communal commemoration and the creation of the event. And the role of the ritual and the symbols, it really, I think, Day of Remembrance really opened floodgates of memories and emotions. And now people started talking about camp. Before, they didn't talk about it. The memories were suppressed, and they tried to just forget. Don't rock the boat, you know. And whereas after Day of Remembrance, they started to talking to each other. And by starting talking to each other, sharing the memories, these rituals served as a catharsis or healings. And it became from individual, suppressed individual memories to collective memories, shared memories. And I think commission hearings also did a lot of, played a vital role in, doing the catharsis and healing too. And I also like to point out this interaction between collective level and individual payment, individual level, because after payment, everybody, you know, those who were interned, received this check and a letter of apology. So they interpreted the meaning of camp experience. And then it was, you know, individual and the family level. But after that, they donated money and education fund came out. So there was this community level, collective level, in which the camp experience was interpreted at a group level. Number four, organized campaigns. Some of us talked a lot about the initial efforts, but we cannot say that the redress made success, at least in Seattle, without people's efforts, without people who took over the initial group, because around 1979, the Seattle Evacuation Redress Committee was dissolving, partly because they were so disappointed to hear that the commission hearing would be created, because they thought it would only delay the payment, and then by meantime, the many estate will be gone. And some of the members got ill, seriously ill, and there was family tragedy, divorce, so they just lost. I mean, they just left. So then, but the new leaders came to take over. People like Cherry Kinoshita, and Chizo Mori, and Wayne Kimura, and all these other people. I don't have time to mention all these names. So we cannot forget, all these the people's efforts to take it over, and carried it. And they did lots of things, prepared the commission hearings, gave talks before Japanese-American gatherings, organizations, wrote letters to politicians, lobbied a state congressional delegation, and so on and so on. Okay, number five, I think Seattle was very much blessed, fortunate to have local Japanese-American artists. The title of my book, Breaking the Silence, came from the play I'm sure that many of you know, the Breaking the Silence, written by Nikki Nojima Lewis. And Roger Shimomura, who is a Sansei artist, who has national recognition, he also did lots of lifetime work on Minnedoka. And like Frank Fuji, and we have writers, and you know, the art really does marvelous, and art has a power. So these are some of the images that Roger Shimomura did, the Minnedoka Diary. Maybe without this title, it may be hard to guess what this art piece means, but this is the title was Notification. So when they look at the notification of the forced removal. And some of you, those who went to pilgrimage last year to Minnedoka, this piece, it should be familiar because this is the official poster of the pilgrimage last year. And as I look at the entire impact of redress, effects of redress on Japanese Americans, I would say for Nisei, I think all these years they had carried shame and scars and stigma, and some of them even said they feel like they were raped. Even though it wasn't their fault, but you feel so ashamed, you know, by being raped, and you don't want to talk about it, you just want to forget. So redress really served as catharsis and healing. And many of them actually talked to me in their interviews that they feel like when they are getting redress, you know, they feel like first time they feel like they become a full citizen. You know, not second-class citizen, but first-class citizen. So the heels and the scars were recovered, even if not to full extent, but to some extent or great extent. And then through redress, they kind of, you know, reaffirmed that they wanted to ongaishi, they wanted to return their gratitude to their parents and parents' friends, the issei. And the sense of community, sense of pride was strengthened. And then they also reaffirmed their mission. You know, somebody who experienced forced removal and imprisonment, they thought it is their mission to raise their voice when something like 9/11 happened. How about for Sansei? You know, they interpreted parents and grandparents and community people's experiences, and also Asian American experiences as a whole. Even though, you know, many of them didn't know until they became teenagers, or they didn't know anything about, they found books about redress, internment or imprisonment. So they started to learn and also reinterpret. And after learning about the experiences of their parents and the community people, they said the pieces, you know, fragmented pieces, came to make one whole picture. Everything they heard, they had heard, or they had seen, makes sense. And sense of community got strengthened, and they reaffirmed respect and appreciation for issei and nisei, and they got gained ethnic pride. And also, it wasn't just learning the history, but they also came to understand contemporary racism, how much parallel, you know, is there. So it really helped their understanding of contemporary racism as well. And they also, as Sansei, they also reaffirmed their mission of Japanese Americans when the 9/11 happened and after things like that. Okay, I have only a few seconds remaining, but how about post-redress? You know, there are still many untold stories that which need to be told, recorded. Excuse me. So we should keep, you know, hearing more voices. But there are other issues. The community cannot just stop with redress and incarceration, memories of incarceration. Like political representation is diminishing. We are losing our congressmen and state legislatures. So how to increase the political voice or political presence. And coalition with other groups, organizations, civil rights organizations is still very important. And also for all these years until redress made a success, U.S.-Japan relation was kind of, you know, low profile. People didn't want to stress the importance of U.S.-Japan relations, but I think it is now it's okay and it should be promoted more. And now, as we know, you know, lots of happens. So that the Japanese American community overall is facing a new challenge. You know, how to be inclusive, how to be as inclusive as possible. And at the same time, how to keep the category and the identity of Japanese Americans as meaningful as possible. I think that both tradition and transformation may be needed to keep advancing. Thank you very much.
As facilitator of this panel, I told them that they could say what they want, and I just try to fill in some of the blanks. Sort of, well, I thought it was very important to talk about Cherry. So the work of Cherry Kinoshita, who was in charge of SCRC when Congress chose to go with the commission plan rather than Lori's bill, needs to be acknowledged in any discussion of redress. She rallied the troops who were angry or dismayed into a driving force for both the commission proceedings and the legislative redress campaigns that followed. And these were state workers' redress, Seattle city workers, Seattle school clerks, and the national level. And I can only sort of relate the results. I just need to relate the results of all these programs or strategies, and you can see what kind of influence she had. Of the commission hearing, she was basically hit a home run, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm quoting from Rafu Shimpo's reporter, Gerald Sato. "There is not a single Nikkei-oriented newspaper published in the Northwest on a regular basis. Yet the Seattle community leaders have been able to obtain absolutely first-rate coverage of the redress campaign in the Northwest from Seattle and Portland dailies and from regional newspapers throughout the state. At the hearing, extensive coverage was also provided by three broadcasting networks, Public Broadcasting, and Dutch Television to Europe. All of this has resulted in a manner of redress being a topic of conversation everywhere in the non-Nikkei Seattle community. On redress legislation, state workers' compensation passed May 6, 1983, signed shortly thereafter by Governor Spellman in 1983. City workers passed without dissent. These are redress to city workers and state workers who were forced to resign. City workers passed without dissent March 5th, 1984, signed by Mayor Royer March 6th. School clerks, school district, 4-2, one abstention for redress. State level for appropriation, signed by Governor Booth Gardner April 1986. And so, oh, there was one other one. The national redress bill. Washington State delegation went 10-0 in favor of redress bill. And I think when you look at that, you know, you can understand what this woman had accomplished, because lobbying is sometimes pretty not very glitzy or fancy or gets news, but lobbying requires, I guess, a lot of grit and determination. And I always thought that Cherry was pushy, but I thought that was kind of a word she wouldn't like, so I kind of used determined. Cherry was very, very determined. And so I think we have to recognize that. I have some other comments that I wanted to make, because when we started my book project, Cherry and I had a great disagreement as to the scope of the book. She wanted an academic book written for graduate school students. She thought it would be more influential. And I argued that I was going to write about, well, maybe for the high school level, more people would read it. I said, if you want an academic book, you got the wrong person. Well, it turned out that the book is being used by graduate students and undergrads alike. And I'm not sure about high school, though. But I know that there has been a greater acceptance of testimony since the ethnic studies movement began, and I realize that a large part of this acceptance that has resulted from the work, a large portion of the acceptance has resulted from the work of groups like Janum, Densho, Wing Luke Museum here, and with the help of a lot of scholars, you know, like Art Hansen and Gail and Steve at the University of Washington, Moon Ho. I mean, there's a group at Washington and Seattle University here that have really helped push forward the importance of having testimony as legitimate academic data. So for that reason alone, I think I can end my duties and thank Janum and all the other community organizations and community history believers that, yes, we do have an important voice and we need to really push that so that everybody's history is included in the greater American history. Thank you. Well, I guess we open it up to questions.
I'll start. That's a really tough question because, I mean, we still have a few Nisei available to us. You know, most of the voices are on videotape now, thanks to the Densho Project. So that would probably synchronize well with the internet and streaming video. If we could, you know, instead of having, you know, in fact, there are no newspapers left anyway. So that you would have to take the voices of people on videotape and then marry that to a social media strategy with change.org, Facebook, and websites and Twitter. So you would try and push that out, you know, using the electronic images as opposed to in-person testimonies. I mean, we have people still left here, like in the audience, who could still tell their stories as well. And those are more compelling than, you know, an electronic image. But it would be challenging, certainly, and you wouldn't have the same groundswell of emotional energy that we had 35 years ago when we had more Nisei with us, and the Issei were still with us, too. So that's an impossible question. That's a very interesting question to consider. Like I say, though, I mean, we would use, if it did today, we'd use change.org and the Facebook community page. I want to put in a plug. We're doing that right now with Stopping the Fence at Tule Lake Airport. So go to your Facebook page, Stop the Fence at Tule Lake, like that page, and then go to the change.org petition and then sign the petition to stop the fence at Tule Lake.
When 9/11 happened and the Muslim community felt very threatened, the first organization they came to in Seattle was the Seattle JACL to get advice on how we started to mount a campaign for redress and how we mobilized the community to fight for civil rights.
It'd be harder now because the moment was just right for redress. The Sansei, like myself, were just coming of age. And we, you know, just becoming adults and could use the tools of the media and have the energy and time. You know, I couldn't do that now, right? and my kids don't care.
Yes.
They don't care. So, I mean, it was the right moment to have the right people, blend of people, to push the issue at that time. And, of course, Congressman Lowry behind us all the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious, like the footage of Mr. Sasaki.
Yes.
No, it's not. Is it ever
going to
be, or is it possible to get?
My plug. I'll put it on my webpage, resistors.com, by the middle of next week. I'll post it.
Because I know, like, the Los Angeles Commission, we have those in our library at Vansmore. I don't
Oh.
But we're using, I work at Vanderbilt.
Oh. For Manzanar, I have to amend that statement. Densho, I interviewed Shosuke at four Densho project. That's video that could be available to you for the Manzanar thing. This video is from CBS News. It's copyrighted. I'm sure they won't care, but it's still, it is copyrighted by CBS News for a Sunday morning program.
What year did you pass away?
Oh, about 10 years ago? 10 mm-hmm. years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. On the $50 million Civil Liberties Redress Fund, $5 million was a good number. President Clinton authorized it, and speaking for myself, I got $100,000 for Conscience of the Constitution for the PBS film, so I was pleased about that. I mean, it was enough for my project. I mean, $50 million would have been, you know, more. Mr. Bonai, I mean, you were around it then. I mean, it would. Sure, $50 million would have been preferable, but $5 million was still a tangible amount and certainly funded a good many projects in the community. This is Paul Bonai, the executive director of the commission.
I don't know if many of you know, but I was the executive director of the Commission on Wartime Relocation, and as a result of it, I'll tell you how it got there. In 1972, I was elected to the Assembly of California through the effort of Ronald Reagan when I helped him become governor. So from then on, I always thought about my family and other people who were evacuated. And my family, if you had a family that were evacuated, they lost an awful lot of things. I know I did, and my family did. So always in my mind I had, we ought to get the government to do something about this. So after I was in the assembly, I lobbied quite a bit in Washington, D.C. I had a friend named Mike Masaoka to help me. And we said that we ought to do something to try to get the United States government to give something for the losses of the Japanese Americans. Now, as I say, we worked all that time, but Congress and the Senate was not interested, but they did say one thing. Maybe we ought to look into it. So they formed this commission, and this commission was to be activated in 1980. And when they did, they said, why do we have the commission? We want to study whether or not the United States government did do anything wrong for Japanese Americans, and if they did, do we compensate for that, and do they get an apology? So in 1980, I was called, and I had just finished my term in the assembly, and I went back because Reagan asked me to go there, and I was given the task of the executive director of the commission. And the commission's job was to have hearings. And if you were in Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco, or any other places, you might have been asked to testify, and you gave your opinion on why you thought that you should be somehow compensated by the government for the tremendous loss of your families. So anyway, the hearings were held. It wasn't 100%. Even the members of our commission, we had one man on there that was very anti, but anyway, most of the commission members finally said that we should. And as a result of that, I wrote a report. And if all of you know, that report was then, my name, I didn't want to, I said, I'm an evacuee, and if the senator or the representative see that I'm going to get a benefit as a one who was evacuated, be wrong. So I hired an attorney, and he helped me, and he wrote the report, and if you know the book, it was given to every senator and every representative, and asked the staff to read it. As a result of that, Congress and Senate passed a bill saying that there would be a $20,000 reparation for the people. So that is something that was good. But the main thing was, they said there would be a formal apology saying that the United States government had made a mistake. And as you know, the President of the United States made that statement. So I think that it's very important to know that a lot of it is as a result of the hearings we held and what the people in each city had to say about their loss and about how they felt about being treated. Okay?
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
In answering the question about what happened to $50 million, what happened was the government did a very good job of finding survivors who did qualify for the payments under the law, and the education bill shrunk. I mean, the money that was supposed to be given for projects shrunk, and that's so that we ended up with only $3 billion or something in the. I mean, it just really went down. I mean, well, I'll just cut it in that.
Bob Bratt did a good job then.
What?
Robert Bratt did a good
job. Yeah, he did. Yeah, I think it has because. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it has because the whole idea was that the people who are controlling the fund kind of made it so that people had to find their own matching funds, and a lot of groups did. And because a lot of the information, a lot of the books came out, and movies and stuff came out, well, it just helped with the next generation. I know people who have benefited from the research done by the original grantees. The next generation of people have used those works to further do research.
Yeah. No question it could have been better. No question they could have done more.
It should have been more.
Yeah, no question.
But could I add that this is the reason why we need to be politically active, because Kip Takuda was elected to the state legislature and he authored a bill to provide the Civil Liberties Education Fund in the state of Washington. And every year, hundreds of thousands of dollars was appropriated to implement that act. And I know in we received some of the money, but
in California as well.
California also did that.
So, I mean,
but it's really important to work politically to get our people elected to office, because once there, well, especially if they remember who their community, you know, who they represent. But Kip has been so instrumental in so many good things that have happened in our city.
I think that Dale may nominate the chair of the Civil Liberties Public Education Fund that administered the $5 million and his board. They did the best they could with the funds they had. I think that we should recognize that, too.
It's not the same thing, but there is also the Japanese-American Climate Sites Grant Program.
That's the new Civil Liberties Fund. That's kind of become the new funding source now,
yeah,
absolutely.
It's about, I think this is what, the fourth year of appropriations. The first year was $1 million. The subsequent 3 years have been $3 million each, so it's about $14 million out of what could be up to $38 million. We don't know if that will happen, but it's not the exact same thing, but it is that helped to finish the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center. It's helping to build the Topaz Museum, so it is at least on those sites, and there's done a lot of plaques and other.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to have to cut this off. So thank you all for coming.